Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Unlock big savings and add style and security to your home with high-quality Schlage door locks from Menards. Whether you're looking for a traditional interior lock or a Wi-Fi compatible electronic lock, Menards has you covered. With more than 200 options of Schlage door locks in stock, save big on all door locks. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Scott Shepherd. I'm founder and CEO of the City's First Podcast and your host for today's live webinar on shared and micromobility in cities. We're proud to partner with UMX Urban Mobility Explained, which offers free self-paced courses, expert videos, webinars, and in-person trainings to help you upskill in urban mobility. Visit urbanmobilitycourses.eu and follow them on LinkedIn for the latest. Joining me today are 3 shared and micromobility leaders in the industry in the US and Canada. First, we have Darius Mason, who is a shared mobility specialist at the City of Detroit. Welcome, Darius. Glad to have you here.
Nice to meet you. Great to be here.
And next we have Julie White, who is the Deputy Secretary for Multimodal Transportation at the North Carolina Department of Transportation. Welcome, Julie. Really happy to have you.
Thanks, Scott.
And then finally, we also have Venkatesh Gopal, who is the CEO of MoveMe, based in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. So welcome, Venkatesh.
Glad to join. Thank you for the invite.
All right. So today we're just going to explore shared micromobility, collaboration, and policy innovation with some real-world lessons from Detroit, North Carolina, Canada, and beyond, and future trends. So without further ado, let's just dive in. And our first topic is around shared and micromobility in cities. So shared micromobility is transforming how cities move, but there are important policy and access questions kind of that abound. So Julie, how is the state of North Carolina leveraging micromobility to create more connected and inclusive transportation?
So at the DOT, one of the things we observed when scooters first came on the scene in the 2017-ish range is that these innovations tend to happen in the big cities first, and then they work their way to like a Charlotte or Raleigh. So New York, LA, and eventually there. But what has been really fun for us is when we actually are able to do the innovation with our smaller towns. So urban mobility can exist in a 25 or 50,000 person town in their urban core. So for us, it was the town of Wilson, North Carolina, that called us and said, we've heard about this micro transit thing. We'd like to do it, but we don't know how. And so we partnered with them to help them figure out all the federal regulations, the keeping it compliant with different federal regulations. And they were able to launch a highly successful first in a rural community microtransit product. We've done the same now with helping smaller towns like Gastonia, North Carolina, with e-scooter programs, smaller college towns. So I think what's really exciting is thinking about how shared and micromobility can help even beyond the traditional large-scale cities, as most of America still doesn't live in those communities, but in more rural and smaller towns.
Excellent. Yeah, no, that's a great perspective and looking at a specific city that's not of the larger scale and kind of outside of what we would commonly associate with this type of mode of mobility. So Darius, could you start by sharing Detroit's approach to shared micromobility and what challenges you're facing in the city?
So the city of Detroit is one of the larger cities that Julie was talking about. And one thing that we've seen with a problem is we brought in the scooters with no permit. The scooter companies just came back in 2018 in that area, and we finally got permitted after watching other cities go through the permit process. We permitted in 2024, 2025. This is our first permit. And one thing we've realized is the concentration we see of the scooter programs was not in the interest of the residents of Detroit. The city of Detroit is 138 square miles, one of my favorite numbers. And the scooter program was only highlighting scooters within the Corktown neighborhood, downtown, midtown, and New Center, which is only about 10 square miles tops of that 138 square miles. So, like, I got hired, and my job was to parse out and find ways to spread out because Detroit does have a lot of urban sprawl. We feel like we're the perfect test city to get all different types of scooter usage, and we've been able to leverage that with these companies and with our vendors. And just last year, I was able to turn that 90% in those three neighborhoods of scooter usage, or well over 90%, almost 95%. Now we've turned that down to around the high 70s. Hopefully next year we'll get that more closer to 50-50, but we know it's going to be a longer challenge than over 2 years. So that's something I'm personally working day and night to get done. And while doing all that, ridership has actually went up among all of our vendors. So, like, I'm proud to say that as well.
And it's interesting you mentioned sprawl because, yeah, that's not always associated with Detroit, but kind of the urban mix, the actual land use and the density. There's nodes of higher density development in the center and certain kind of neighborhood zones, but it is a very horizontal city, shall we say, a city of freeways. It's not just Los Angeles, it's Detroit. Actually, I think Detroit was one of the first cities of freeways. So not to get off on a tangent, but it's interesting because that plays into the mix in terms of what is the proper distribution, as well as kind of interface between the operators for where micromobility can thrive. So that's some great points that you make specifically to Detroit. So thanks for
Yeah, can I
sharing
follow up
that.
this? Oh, can I follow up that really quick? Like, and that's why I always say, like, Detroit might be, like, for scooter providers, might be the perfect city just because we have tourism because our city is so sprawling. The suburbs, for instance, if you live out in a Canton or a Novi, you're traveling in and commuting in and then coming downtown. You may need micromobility just to get around downtown because it's almost as if you're going to a whole different city or a whole different state because of how far it is.
It's kind of an unknown fact of Detroit. I think let's go down this rabbit hole for a second. My family's all from Michigan and whatnot too.
Okay.
But it's interesting because it is a bit of an oxymoron because it's an older industrial city. It has, like I said, the higher density, but it has the kind of the Los Angeles, Atlanta, Phoenix, suburban sprawl, but of an earlier era back in the 19 teens and 20s. Back before those cities were sprawling, Detroit was, when it was in
Yes.
its industrial prime and everything. So I think that is the perfect, let's say, test lab for what we're kind of talking about here in terms of maybe learning from what other cities circa 2017, 2018 tried and maybe didn't work so well. So let's hope that Detroit can get it right. So without further ado, Venkatesh, we're really eager to hear your perspective on this topic.
Thanks. No, it was I'm just happy listening to Julie and Darius. This is like great perspectives of the state regulations, city regulations, bigger city, smaller city. We have everything already in this webinar. And I think from what we've seen at MoveMe, we've seen smaller cities, bigger cities. We work with cities, we work with operators. So that way it's a lot of our work is about feasibility and making sure that operations can stand on their own feet. Because we, as consultants, we started working with like car sharing and in when it was like a very novel idea, 10 years, 12 years back. And one, I wanted to take a step back and just give us a link between how shared mobility has been looked at evolutionarily. And that way, I think for car sharing, it has been cities are always very welcoming and very car friendly in terms of the infrastructure, the rules, the policy. So it was easier for car sharing companies to like do what Darius mentioned scooter companies did, right? To just come, drop a few cars, start a car sharing company. And not many people noticed because the cars were still parked where other cars were supposed to be parked. People knew, and everybody has this idea of, you're not going to run a car over a sidewalk or park it in a park or something like that. It's still a car rental. People are aware of it. So it was a known model, known shape, form factor, and people just took to it, and car sharing models survived. What happened with micro mobility is this is now a novel device. So it's a small one. People can have this perspective of they can do whatever they want. They can take it anywhere they want. It seems it has this illusion of being affordable. I still feel there are like ways to go before micromobility becomes really affordable for a daily commute and that kind of use. But before the cities got onto like docked and dockless and that kind of definition, this is what we saw in every city. What Darius mentioned and what Julie also mentioned in other cities that has happened in North Carolina, scooter companies coming in, throwing around a few hundred scooters and then seeing how people react to it. While technically for a pilot, it seems okay, but we know how users behave to that kind of a infrastructure less device. And this is where I also feel it was important for bigger cities to jump on board and make sure that the permit system works and allows users to use it wisely or lay out a structure to guide how to use. So, they went with docked bike share first and then looked at how dockless could fit in this ecosystem. But to Julie's point, we also saw in Metro Vancouver and in BC, in Canada, smaller cities were pretty upbeat about welcoming shared micromobility more than the larger ones, right? And I think in general, it worked for people who are traveling around BC, who are traveling around Canada. They went to smaller cities for, tourism, for small vacation, all of that, and they experienced some of the scooter sharing there. So I think it was a good way of companies like Lime and everybody else to evaluate how Canadian cities are going to look like, and at the same time, Canadians to experience scooters and e-bikes. So we had the first of the scooter sharing that started in British Columbia province was in Kelowna. And then we had e-bikes in North Vancouver. So Vancouver came just very recently with the whole scooter sharing program. But before that, it was all about the smaller cities. So there is a very good precedence of how smaller cities help adjust the regulations to a local, behavioral change.
Exactly. So our next question is for actually we'll continue with you, Venkatesh. I think this is a good segue. We're going to focus on public-private collaboration and policy innovation. And the question is around collaboration and policy are vital for success. So Venkatesh, maybe you can share some examples of innovative policies or partnerships that you've seen internationally.
Some of them are about integrating. Some of them are about laying out the land for, experimentation. And I think one of the policies that comes to mind when it comes to like the do's and the don'ts. So let's go with the don'ts first. So the city of Kelowna went with like an innovative incline, more extreme innovation kind of a policy where they invited all scooter sharing companies to come start operating. That's it. So that was basically the invitation, and scooter sharing companies obliged, right? So everybody came with their fleet. Whoever wanted to have a chance to apply for bigger cities like Toronto, Calgary, and Vancouver in Canada, they all went in and poured their scooter fleets on the small city of Kelowna. And naturally, it became a mess. It was a huge problem for the city to deal with. City has their own problems in terms of staff and how they would manage. It was all chaos. It was new. Citizens started using it, but then also residents started complaining that there are so many scooters in front of my house and those kind of things. So it became a big, pool of mess with scooters, free-floating scooters lying all around a city which has like about, at the time, it was like about 90,000 population. So it is a smaller city. So and then in so that was one of the things that we would advise cities not to go with. And I think most of the cities now, when they look at scooter sharing and micromobility in general, they're very, very cautious, which is a good thing. And then flip over to something like Vancouver, right? So and here's where it's the city of Vancouver. I love what we have here as an ecosystem. It's thriving. It makes sure that all the modes are operationally viable. But at the same time, I think from the scooter sharing perspective, it's one of the most creative ones to yet to see how the impact of that goes with the users, because we have the first ever docked scooter sharing. Yeah, I think I'm defining it correctly. First ever docked scooter sharing company, scooter sharing program, citywide. So, and we've already had a docked bike share. So this is basically a docked scooter sharing right next to docked bike sharing kind of systems.
Warning: the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile. And you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine.
F
Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ziprecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ziprecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ziprecruiter.com/zip.
And the pricing's also made sure that the e-scooters are equally priced as the e-bikes on subscription. So there are innovations coming up in terms of like making it affordable, making it organized, making it easy to regulate from the regulator side, but also from the user side, we know where to expect. I mean, as a user, I know where to expect a scooter, where to expect a bike when there is a dock, other than a free floating. So coming back to like the public-private partnerships, it needs to be localized. It needs to take a step towards, how much of this innovation could be affordable from the operator side, because they have to make it reliably feasible for themselves. Otherwise, they will not stick around. And then on the other side, the regulators have to, the operators also have to, if there is a loophole in regulations. It's less about how operators should be exploiting that, but operators should go ahead and, in my opinion, they should be advising the cities in a way that, okay, these are things that may fall apart. So there is a better way of managing this. Maybe we should do something like this, right? So, and I think that way the public-private partnerships needs to take that kind of step where both sides need to understand, the cities and the regulators need to understand the feasibility side of things. And the operators need to understand the organizing and the not creating a mess kind of side. And both are eventually only looking at ridership, right? So everybody's trying to grow multimodal ridership and a car-free, promote a car-free lifestyle and enable like active transportation and walking and those kind of eco-friendly modes and healthier modes in our cities. So either ways, if systems don't thrive, and they won't if public-private partnerships are not cemented as the foundation, if systems won't thrive, then we cannot expect a behavioral change anytime.
Very strong considerations that we should all think about kind of going forward. So Julie, what public-private collaborations have you seen that have made a difference across North Carolina?
So I'm going to pick up on what Venk Kanesh talked about a bit. I think it was July 2017. We call it the night the birds landed in Raleigh. It was this idea that they came and just dropped a couple hundred scooters overnight in Raleigh with no warning to anyone. And our highway building, our DOT headquarters, is right here in the heart of our downtown, across the street from the state capitol. A lot of one-way, multi-lane roads. And our engineers, I walked the hallway with our top engineers that morning as they're looking out their windows, just in awe, terror, depending on what you saw, because they saw this vehicle they'd never seen before going the wrong way on one ways, on sidewalks, on the road. What I saw was a huge amount of the population saying, "This is interesting. This fits a need I have," right? So the statistic is something like 60% of vehicle travel takes place in less than a 2 mile trip. And so when you live in the South, particularly three seasons a year, it's hot. And so if you got to go a mile and a half, 2 miles, you might very well be getting in your car just for it's hot. And so I think the scooters define this space in our transportation network that was in need of a solution. And so I think the partnership comes in when these vendors and providers realize that when they do it in partnership with the city, the whole thing can be more successful. We spent a lot of initial time here in North Carolina thinking, how do we regulate these away? Because of that approach that I think it was taken by the vendors. How do we legislate them out of existence? How do we, ban them from our streets? And so I think the partnership comes from when the vendors get together with the communities and say, what's the need? Where does it belong? How is it going to operate? And then we design something that's going to work for the community. I think, through the iterations of this, we've seen, for example, people really hated seeing the scooters left around on the sidewalks, blocking people's access to sidewalks. Now we're doing the communities, the cities are doing parking corrals. So they're coming up with a solution that helps the vendors succeed and stay in the market. So I think it's that kind of collaboration that Venkatesh talked about in figuring out what works and how do we keep the good and fix the bad.
Absolutely. And learning from kind of the earlier, let's say, successes and challenges in this kind of first wave of micromobility. So, Darius, maybe you can shed some light on maybe now here in 2025, fast forward like 6, 7 years, what are you guys kind of doing to address this problem and kind of leverage the opportunity of working together with the private sector now that the private sector, as we see, has taken a shift in tone from 7 years ago, and for lack of a better word, is collaborating more, whether they're forced to or whether they want to. So I think it's interesting to see maybe what you guys are doing.
Firstly, one thing that's helped us with leveraging the private-public partnership is the fact that now the scooter companies have been around, and he's definitely in the major markets for at least 7 years. Leadership, well, on the public side, no, they're not going anywhere. Even the cities that have gotten rid of scooter programs, most of them normally bring them back. That's the trend we're seeing across the United States. I don't, like we saw it in Dallas, we saw it in Atlanta. So like that also gives us like more. I'm lucky enough to work in my mayor's office and not in my DOT, where I can have a more poignant conversation with vendors. And one thing we do is we want the vendors to be successful here as much as the vendors want to be successful here, because of a successful financial scooter program for the companies also mean there's more scooters out here providing need and providing ridership. So we've been able to like carve out more business-friendly RFPs. We'll probably talk about RFPs and that process later in this podcast. But allowing to have like we know no matter what the scooter program, because we know the cities in them states won't buy 2,000 scooters to operate themselves. So we know coming to the table that we already have to rely on these vendors. So, but we also know that we control whether the vendors can be here or not. So like having that brick wall between what the vendors can do and what the municipalities can do has given us a way to work in that middle ground in between the two fences and create something that the residents of Detroit and the tourists of Detroit can enjoy. It makes contract negotiations going forward a little bit more exciting, honestly, just because now that scooters are this mainstay, and I don't think anyone here believes they'll ever go away, that now we can get a little bit more creative and get more ambitious when it comes to the scooter and the bike share programs within the city.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because they're not going away. Even though we've seen different responses from cities, there's been kind of all ends of the spectrum in terms of kind of like you mentioned, contract negotiations, how these permits are going to bid to tender, and then a lot of the new, let's say, processes around concessions and a little bit of the trading involved between the cities and the operators. And I'm going to kind of dovetail on that. I want to add another kind of, let's say, insight to that. Maybe Venkatesh, maybe you can add to that in terms of some of the concessions you've seen, at least in British Columbia around the Vancouver area. What has been some of your experiences around how that has evolved, maybe specifically to the Vancouver program and docked scooter sharing?
Yeah, gladly. It's one of the things that I'll acknowledge before I talk about the Vancouver and the local programs that we've seen, is the whole industry has evolved, right? So it's not the players are not, whether it's the public side or the private side or even the users, we are not in 2017 and 2018 kind of space right now. So and the industry is self-corrected. So compared to the number of players and the number of services we had back in 2018, 20, even 2019, we have far less. So I think the industry itself has self-corrected, and that way the strongest, the survival of the fittest or whatever. And but the ones who are the operators which are resilient are surviving. And there are so many more operators that we don't hear. I mean, it's not just I'm every time I find out about an operator for a specific city, for a specific province in some country around the world, I'm surprised that it sometimes it's not, many times it's not the Lime or the Bird or the Voi or the Tier, right? And they have, and first sometimes I think that, oh, it should be like about, 300 scooters or like a teeny tiny company somewhere. But sometimes it's like 4,000 scooters with a small company. And that way, being a consultant, we should be top on top of so many things. But I am taken by surprise, like I had no clue about that company. And so that way it's, and I when I look back into the in the partnerships of how they've been working with that particular city or that particular province, then it turns out like it's been very local. It's been a very, happy relationship between the cities and the operators, and they've been there for a few years now. So that way, it's not like the cities are experimenting and it's just the past 6 months or something. There are systems that are thriving. And it may not be the world famous ones, but at the same time, to Darius's point, everybody knows scooters are not going anywhere for the very fact. And the good thing about shared micromobility right now is it gives a very solid precedence to set behavioral change and behavioral expectations for whether you're sharing a scooter or owning one, right? So like or not, people are going to keep buying scooters and then riding. And we have, I mean, at least in BC and Canada, I've seen so many 12-year-olds and 11-year-olds riding e-scooters. And it's not legal, everybody knows, but parents have given those scooters as birthday presents to their kids and they ride around, right? But at least with, safety in numbers kind of a situation where you have a if the scooters and the e-bikes are so common for people to see and for behavioral change to take place, then everybody knows how to behave around them, whether you're riding them or not, whether you're in a car, whether you're a pedestrian, everybody expects what that's supposed to happen. And then that way it's safety and it thrives, to Darius's point. So coming to the some of the affordability aspects and how the permit have been creative. So taking, for example, Vancouver, It's a long-term permit program, right? So it has Lime is the one which is operating in Vancouver. And it's a, like I said, it's the docked scooter share. As users, you're supposed to be like taking, and it's literally like unlocking the scooter from the docking system, like a bike share, traditional bike share, taking the scooter out, and then anywhere you can park, unless as far as there is a docked system there. And the two things that I love about this is, one, it's a long-term contract for the operator. So that way, Lime is technically able to continue the contract for up to 15 years, but there are like checkpoints every 5 years, or even like maybe sooner. But that way, I like it because it takes away that painstaking process of not committing, or committing so much of capital expenditure for a program, but then not being sure if that's going to be used by somebody else, or they will, tomorrow be asked to like just pack up and go. Because a dock system and a lot of like innovative like pricing strategies that Lime is applying for the city of Vancouver, these are the good things that they've been doing. And this is something that would give, this would be only beneficial in the long term. So they need to stick around. They have invested in this market. They are investing in the market. And we need to give the users and Lime to like, get together and make sure that it is a thriving system. And if it is not, then it is just going to be a waste of time, waste of energy, and a lot of waste in terms of investment. In terms of pricing, also, the Lime system has a long-term pricing in terms of like an annual subscription. So I, as a user, can take an annual subscription for Lime scooters, and the pricing for per-minute rides for my scooter would be equal to the e-bikes that I could rent from a docked city bike share program. So it's city bike share program is not the, I mean, it's not the cheapest, but it's far more affordable than a pay-as-you-go kind of a Lime scooter or Lime e-bike program elsewhere, right? So instead of a 40 cent per minute, it's, I think, about like 19 cents or 15 cents a minute. So it's quite subsidized, and that way, I think the carrot that has been given is, you can stick around for longer. And I think that assurance for an operator allows them to commit to the market. So they are like, okay, we don't have to think about making profits in 12 months. We are thinking about making this as a profitable market over the, 3 years or 5 years or something, because they know they are here. And that's a good thing. The other problem with that kind of an aspect is it's a super focused program into the city of Vancouver. And that's where I think more than me, maybe Scott, you, Julie, and Darius, you would also be able to add to this, the interjurisdictional dynamics that happen for our mobility needs. I mean, Darius mentioned about how people move from the suburbs to the downtown, and then now they don't want to use their cars, they use the scooters, right? Now, in the city of Vancouver, I should be able to ride across the border. Now, these are like invisible borders. These are municipality borders, but as a user, I don't see that, my friend or my kid's playdate is in Burnaby and not in Vancouver. So when I'm crossing the boundary between Vancouver and Burnaby, it's basically a road that my daughter's friend lives across. And for us, if we are not able to use the bike share system or the car share system, then that's a pain in, it's in that forces me to either drive or think about some other way to get there, right? So if there is no public transit or something. And that's where I think the behavioral change is then asked to like cut off. And then now you're asking me to look at like, in look at my transportation behavior in silos. And I think that's one of the things that needs to be innovated in terms of permits to look at like regional and interjurisdictional dynamics. And yeah, I will leave it there. And hopefully, we have other examples from North Carolina and Michigan to look at that.
I like
God, if I
yeah, please, yes,
if I
continue.
can pick up on one of the points there that Venkatesh made. The city of Raleigh recently did an analysis on their bike share program, and I thought this was really interesting. The scooter system, because the permitting pays the city, right? So it's a city revenue source. The bike share system, because it's so much more expensive, the city was subsidizing. So they found that they were subsidizing the bike share to the tune of about $35,000 a month. And the scooters, they were making about $7,500 a year. So I think it's a really interesting dynamic. So the city is piloting, they're going from docked bike share to undocked bike share without a public subsidy. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that model when they move to that. And also to Venkatesh's point about these boundaries and borders, when a lot of these were first introduced, the college campus like NC State and Raleigh had its own permit and its own system and a geofence accordingly. And then the city had a different one. Well, the university kids wanted to get from the campus to something in the city, that invisible boundary, right? That geofence wouldn't allow the trip. And so it's been really good to see the innovation, the recognition of where people want to go and figure out how do we allow those cross boundaries. So we've definitely seen some real progress, particularly in the college-city relationships in that space.
Yeah, well, Darius, I have some thoughts too, but Darius, so maybe you can give us some perspectives in Detroit on the same topic.
Oh, jurisdiction. If you guys don't know, we have two enclosed, like within the city limits of Detroit. Like they're totally surrounded by the city limits of Detroit suburbs that have their own governments, their own municipalities, their own everything. And they're also geofenced out of the scooter program. So, like, if you go up our main street, what where you actually go through both of those cities? And scooters do cut off at them invisible boundaries. And it literally, like, those cities are called Hamtramck and Highland Park, and they're their own municipalities, own governments, own everything. One thing I'm trying to do, and this is something that this conversation coming up right now is kind of perfect. I'm trying to, like, find a way to make it more regionalized, the scooter programs, or any provider that comes and makes a hub in Detroit can also, like, instantly make a contract with those two, definitely those two enclosed suburbs, because riders, and I've seen this with my eyes, are trying to go to a friend's house in Hamtramck, and they are dragging the scooter along to drag it back to so that they can take it to their house on the north end. It is very depressing, honestly, just seeing as a person who runs the scooter program, like, oh, that is a huge problem for people. And not just that, we also have a dearth of vehicles being stuck out there, and then we have to the rebalancing process becomes even longer because the providers have to go out there and then drive them back in the city limits and then turn them on to be rebalanced. It's been a pain and a headache. It's been a pain and a headache for me personally. And also, I want to expand it to the northern and western suburbs as well. Not eastern, because eastern is an entirely different country. That's, but.
Oh, you mean like Grosse Pointe, that area?
Yeah. Grosse Pointe and, like, southeastern is Windsor. Because Bird used to be both Windsor and Detroit. So,
Oh,
like,
in Canada.
Yeah, our fleet would actually, some of our fleet would be in Detroit, and we'd have to tell the Detroit Bird team, hey, could you please go get them vehicles, please? Because you're below minimum.
And they're like, I'm not crossing the bridge.
Exactly. Like, oh, it's so much
I'm
to go
looking at the
across the
map
border.
behind you right now, so that's actually a good reference.
Yep.
Speaking of jurisdictional boundaries, yeah, I am a native of Los Angeles. As you can imagine, Los Angeles County is over 120 municipalities, 11 million people, larger than many nations in the world. And the if you guys ever seen a map, the actual city boundaries of the city of Los Angeles make no sense at all. So if you can imagine operating a scooter shared scooter program in LA, whether it's geofencing or not, and having a diametrically opposed, let's say, mandate of permitting within jurisdictional boundaries, contradictory to natural boundaries. And the natural boundaries in LA would be on the north, you have the San Gabriel Mountains. On the west and the south, you have the Pacific Ocean. So you have these natural kind of regional boundaries where could be quite amenable, quite natural for these different mobility options. But, let's say the land use, the politics, and many other factors over the last century make it quite challenging to implement a lot of these new mobility options. So it's a challenge, but an opportunity. One thing I think that resonated with me, Venkatesh, I know we're going down the rabbit hole here, is you mentioned about kind of demand and kind of building, let's say, a kind of a captive audience, enough of a critical mass, I think you mentioned, of people that would start using, and it becomes like a snowball, starts building momentum. So I want to get a little more controversial now. This is a little off topic, but let's talk about it. It's the elephant in the room is some of the cities that have banned scooters and have went against the natural progression. They went against the critical mass and they went against consumer preference. And in this case, the city I'm going to talk about, this consumer preference are primarily in the generation of Gen Z and millennials. And that city is Paris, France. So they kneecapped and they basically banned scooters throughout the city, as we all know, in April of 2023. That's when they had their kind of popularity vote. And then the permit expired, I believe it was in August of 2023. So let's talk about that for a moment and get your guys' thoughts, because how is it that the political will or forces or people in City Hall or other stakeholders may, let's say, act in contrary to what the will of the people and the consumers in terms of, in the case of Paris, a wildly popular program, albeit it has naturally progressed more into kind of docked and dockless bike share in Paris. So th they've had a soft landing, shall we say, after canceling the scooters, but it wasn't without its challenges, and perhaps it could have been done a lot differently, and a bit more democratically. So whoever wants to join on that one.
I'll go
Well,
first.
Scott, it's go ahead.
I'll go first. Sorry. One thing that we are seeing here in Detroit is different stakeholders have their own different agendas of where they want the scooter program to be or not be. Like, there are certain neighborhoods that have requested that they don't want scooters on certain streets. Geofencing off a street just because of preference is never going to happen in the city of Detroit. I told the neighborhood associations that, like, if there's a safety reason, like it's a pedestrian-only street, then we can have that conversation. But if it's just because the business owners don't like to see the young kids driving up and down on scooters, that's unacceptable to me.
Forget it. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Like we've run into problems from different departments within the city that also want to limit scooters. Like currently we have a 10 p.m. to 3 a.m. curfew on the weekends that is also just undoable for a lot of people that go to events on the weekends. Like if a basketball game happens on a Saturday night, the game ends at 11:30. Now people can't use scooters. That's something that has been a huge issue here. Something we're trying to rectify before the next basketball hockey season. But yeah, like there's been so many stakeholders with so many different reasons. That's why the Paris situation is a bit alarming to see that the entire government banned scooters off of just one or two different stakeholders, and found the justification for it. Because it is bucking against a trend. Even the cities that banned them back during the Wild Wild West days of the pre-pandemic and pandemic, they've all come back. Like we've seen Dallas bring scooters back. We've seen Atlanta bring scooters back. I think we've seen in the United States almost every city that bans scooters bring them back, except probably the cities in Pennsylvania, and that's because that's a state ordinance. So seeing Paris do it, definitely over in Europe, which is much more micro-mobility friendly than the United
It
States,
is,
just in
yeah.
general. Just seeing that is alarming on our end. That's something that, like, we're also talking to providers because we're in the middle of procuring our next permit, talking to providers, letting them know that as long as the Office of Mobility Innovation exists, the scooter program will exist. So you guys don't have to worry about us caving to a Greek town or just one specific stakeholder.
Yeah. Oh, maybe Venkatesh, you want to come back to, or Julie? Yeah, Julie, I guess.
So I'll share. I had a electric. I was an early adopter of an electric bike. I bought one back, years and years ago, and took it with me on a vacation to Hilton Head Island. Great place to bicycle. Very bike friendly community. I was very excited, and I was riding my electric bike, and a gentleman stopped on the road to yell at me out his window. He said, "Those are not allowed here. Those are banned here." And I didn't know. And I said, "Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know." And he was wagging his finger at me, and he said, "They're dangerous. People don't operate them properly. They go too fast on them. And I was struck that his problem was not with the tech, but with the operator, right? So I don't operate it wildly and at inappropriate speeds. It helps me be able to, my children bike and they can go many more miles than I can. So it enables me to go as many miles as my family can, because I'm not a teenager anymore. And so I kind of think about the communities that rear up, I think often have concerns about the way in which the unit is operated. And they have issue with the safety concerns. And I think those are often legitimate concerns. We saw last year, I think there was a JAMA article about ER visits are up from scooters and e-bikes. And what we see a lot of is people wearing operating them without helmets. We see especially young people are now getting their own e-bikes. Their parents are buying for them. And these are 30 mile an hour e-bikes that, 13, 14, 15-year-olds are riding. They don't necessarily know how to operate them safely. And so I think there's something to be said about how do we think about how do we train operators on the safe way to use them, where they belong in the road space, at what speeds they belong, what is e-assist versus, a fully 35 mile an hour vehicle. I think there's still, with any innovation, there's a period in which you have to learn how to use these things appropriately. And I think that's the period we're still in.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, and it's kind of a parallel path to the maturity in the market as well. And there's many learnings that we're kind of taking from that. But Venkatesh, maybe back to you. This is your insight. What kind of sparked this dovetail question? So maybe you can kind of bring us back full circle here, and where I kind of alluded to the Paris example.
I'm happy to hear what Julie and Darius just mentioned. So I think, and from Darius's point, I know it needs to be like we wish that all cities had an OMI, right? But it's we are not lucky enough to have that. So I think that kind of a strong belief in it's not going anywhere. We got this. We're going to take care of this kind of a attitude is we are seeing that in cities, but also municipalities have their own challenges of like how big this team is and what kind of voice they have in terms of the council and get it approved and those kind of things. I think that's there is that kind of a it's a slippery slope for them to watch for, and then complaints like these, like how Julie mentioned about users not abiding by what the safety regulation should be, right? And this takes me to like what happened to we used to have drones all the everywhere else, and everybody used to just buy drones and start flying them out. Now they don't. So there are rules around that. People have enforcements, and even from the neighborhood people, everybody's like talking to you when you fly a drone. I don't, but if somebody did, then you would just be like there is a lot of like friction and deterrent behavior there. And I think in scooters and e-bikes, it's giving some space to like correct that, and that way some kind of these feedbacks and all of that is pushing people towards like, oh, maybe I should be using a helmet. If I use a helmet, nobody's going to ask me about this. If I don't ride on this street on in this way, then nobody's going to ask me about something else, right? Not to say that we should be moving scooters away from certain streets or even communities or even cities, but I think we need to create places and create a space for them. And there needs to be a defined space of how scooters are used, right? So in terms of infrastructure, in terms of policy, in terms of safety, there is so much to do in terms of educating the users, making sure that operators focus on the right things and not just about like their rides per scooter per day kind of a metric. I mean, sure, we know that operators, the service providers need to focus on that for their own feasibility. They have a business to run. But at the same time, that's a causal KPI, if I may, for what the riders feel like, right? So the rider comfort, the rider safety, the non-rider safety and comfort is important to take into consideration before we get into like the nitty-gritty of like how many rides did you have per day per scooter and is it going to be feasible and whatnot. So and even for cities, I think some of the cities just went ahead and opened up the gates for like, okay, did some kind of a math calculation and said that, okay, we would welcome about 4,000 scooters in our city. And I think that those kind of decisions need to be questioned a couple of times internally, just to, you know, do we think we can handle like 4,000 scooters? What do we imagine how service providers, what role service providers will play in terms of enforcing? Because you ask any of the service providers to provide, if any city had a problem around safety, they say, okay, now we need the service providers to provide helmets. Sure, they'll provide helmets, but who's going to make sure that the users use them? There are so many scooters and e-bike programs that people don't use helmets. And it may be for a bad hair kind of a concern, it may be for a hygiene concern, whatever. But users are not easy to change their behavior to use something like that. And so that could be a parameter for a city to like then, oh, scooter sharing companies do not enforce or do not make sure that riders wear helmets all the time. And that's why this is not safe. And that's why we are going to ban. Like, come on. How's that going to be feasible? It's a user behavior which needs to be focused and not the tech. So how much ever tech as a service provider they will provide, if they provide the fanciest helmets, if they provide the, you know, the helmet selfies, which automatically with AI they evaluate whether you're they verify whether you're wearing a helmet or not. Not all the scooter providers can provide that. So is the regulation meant for only the big VC funded operators like service providers? It shouldn't be. You should be giving way to like local providers to stick around and make this a thriving business. And the secondly, like the sidewalk riding, right? So there is so much tech involved. There is so much of hue and cry about sidewalk riding. We are not in this place. I don't know if we would ever be in that space where the accuracy would be as we want it as regulators. So if you, and it's only going to create other issues if I ride very close to a sidewalk, because most of the sharrows or bike lanes, guess where they are? Right next to the sidewalk. So when I ride on a bike lane, there is a chance that my GPS bounces in and off, on and off. And then that way I may have a sudden, you know, halt in my scooter. And it could be a safety concern, or it could just be a comfort problem. Now you're deterring me as a user from using these shared ones, but I'm still going to go and buy a scooter because I like the scooter. I'm going to buy a scooter and ride the 35 kilometer per hour scooter on the street because I can, right? So I think the regulations need to be, and Paris, coming back to your point, Scott, Paris did not ban own scooters. They banned shared ones. And I went like, oh, come on. This is like, if you had safety concerns, there are so many more issues with like own scooters. So it's basically like the regulations just brushing off, like, if it is own scooters, it's not my responsibility, kind of a thing. And this is where I think cities did not, some of the cities have not taken it the right way. If there is a, I mean, Paris has enough options to move around, so that way it's all right. But when it comes to like banning scooters, yeah, it's you've had so many years of making that behavioral change. Take that away. Now you're even deterring people from using anything else that comes into the city.
It's cherry picking, as we say. It wasn't a full writ large, let's say, ban, and it was certainly targeting a certain offer and profile. So I think that that's kind of interesting learnings that we've taken from a particular city, and you know, how this can be brought forward in terms of something that is a little bit more comprehensive. So, just to kind of wrap up our discussion here, let's kind of look at the future outlook. And to kind of finish off, what emerging innovations or policies excite you most in making transportation more accessible and connected? So, let's start with Darius. This is the final round of questions.
All right. What I'm most excited for is two things that I'm personally working on right now. One is neighborhood scale mobility hubs. We just had a workshop for the term mobility hubs with the stakeholders in the community and with people. And one thing that my urban planning brain loved was the fact that like the people didn't want big transit centers. They wanted small, very attainable within like we have seven council districts here. They said they want at least three in each council district, certain miles apart, where it's small, it's no bigger than the entire space, including parking lot for each charge, and would be probably the same size as a gas station at the very most. They wanted a small, be able to have all the options there, have a place for people to sit and wait on the bus, and also a place where people can like get that scooter once they get off the bus, or once they go to the mobility hub for some vending, get the scooter and go home on that last mile. That's exactly what they want, which I didn't think that the general public would actually want. I thought that was just my urban plannerese saying, oh, this is what people will love. But to actually hear that without them being coached into it, and when they just saw the different options, they were like, we don't need another big transit center where everything is. We want small things in our neighborhood that represent our neighborhoods. That's something that's been very encouraging for me. And then the second thing is one thing is a pipe in the sky dream right now, but I'm hoping to get this done in 2026, is a mobility wallet. Like hearing the subscription model, like Venkatesh has already brought up, having that a subscription model of a Lime or of a company, scooter companies, and having that built into our DDOT and our smart transportation systems, and people to go on one app and just do a mobility wallet or subscription model so they can get the scooter trips they want or the pricing, have that locked in so that they're not spending exorbitant prices just to get around our city. I would love to get our people mover involved in that and just have like a one-stop app or a one-stop website where you can get to any of the different types of modes of transportation and it already be integrated in. I feel like all of the companies I've mentioned got the APIs for that. It's just getting everybody on board in the same room and agreeing to it. That is something I will be working on all 2026. So.
Yeah, well, it sounds to me like mass mobility as a service, which has had its opportunities and challenges, but maybe Detroit can get it right. So I wish you the best of luck on that. Or we're talking about some form of mobility as a service, but let's see. Maybe in this third or fourth wave, we've had enough, let's say, lessons learned that it becomes a lot more pragmatic. So, Julie, what are your thoughts on kind of the look ahead?
Sure. Now, Darius really hit the nail on the head. Part of my responsibilities here are across all the modes. So I've got ferry responsibilities for our ferry system, for our rail system. And so for us, it really is about the integration of the trip. So how do we, and because, we talk about APIs, we talk about procurement, these are really complex things. So as a state DOT, we're looking at how do we put all these different providers of all these different services onto contracts so that our local communities can just come in and take advantage of that contract and integrate the modes. So our ferry system is predominantly vehicle because there is no solution on the other side of that water for them. So where we can build in scooters and bikes as a last mile solution, we will increase the ridership on the ferry and the rail and the bus. So I think that's where, for me, as you said, Scott, the mobility as a service, getting that concept, I think will grow the entire network.
Yeah, and we've had many different pilots. So we have a lot of pilot fatigue in mass mobility as a service. So whether it's at the state level, at the city level, and maybe it's more successful in the United States, surprisingly enough, than in Europe, where Europe has had a lot more experience in mass than the US has had, which is a bit more kind of dabbled on the edges, obviously because it's more car-centric culture, all that stuff. But that's kind of par for the course. But maybe on a more pragmatic level, we can see some more success. I know Venkatesh, there's been some interesting work with TransLink on Mass. I know you guys have with the Move Me and everything. Maybe we can kind of talk about that and how Mass in British Columbia is integrated with the path ahead for micromobility and what is the kind of path forward.
Yeah, I was excited to see how both Julie and Darius are looking at like integration, not just digitally, but also physically, right? So there is mobility is physical, but at the same time, our lives are now so much digital. So it needs to be checking the box on both sides. And this is happy to be involved in the MaaS pilot in Vancouver. So as MoveMe, we've been project managing the MaaS concept from since 2019. So the first phase was basically just using a fare card, the transit fare card, and tapping it for transit payments, tapping it for car share, unlocking the car share vehicle, and tapping it for the bike share, the docked bike share. And since that pilot, that was we started that in 2019. Then we continued it, although it was 2020. And then by end of 2020, we just had to call it off because that's all the budget was there for like a 1 year pilot and like about 11 months, I think. But in that pilot, one of the key things that came up was, and this was a more B2B kind of a pilot where we onboarded companies and their employees would use these cards. And there was like special cards, special branded ones, and they could go and use this. The one thing that I would say how this has helped us evaluate integration in terms of different modes is 30% of the respondents for the survey, so about like 150 people, agreed that they used a new mode for the first time. So being in Vancouver, so car sharing has been in Vancouver for, I think, since 2016, even before, I think maybe 2014. And bike share has been there, I think, since 20, again, 2014, 2015. So, and TransitLink has been there forever, right? But people in that 30%, there are people who use transit for the first time. And for me, who uses multimodal all the time, I'm like, how did you get around Vancouver again before using transit? I mean, how could you not use transit at all? So we clearly were speaking to people who are so dependent on their cars to drive them around or just walk, right? Either they live in like that 15-minute walkable community and they've never required to travel outside, which I find hard to believe. I mean, you'd have taken a bus trip or a ferry somewhere, but then not having tried the transit trip. So that gave us the fuel to like go ahead and launch this pilot around the app. So now we have an app which allows you to book, pay, and plan, book, and pay for car share, bike share, and transit trips. Transit, you can't pay through the app, but yeah, this is where we are evaluating. It's been on since April. It will be there until December. So yeah, Darius, hopefully by end of December, we will have some stats to release and share with you, helping you with your 2026 project of how you want to integrate. Yeah, we and it's I will say it's painstakingly difficult to get people in the room and agree on certain things in terms of service providers than actually integrating technology-wise, right? So technology there seems to be like, yeah, we can do that, but then agreeing, getting them to agree that they want to do this. Oh, this is like conflict. So our project management has been mostly conflict resolution. So that's what we've been doing for the last 5 years. So yeah, it's funny how MaaS is looked at that now than anything else. And in terms of like mobility hubs, it's something that gives rise to these thoughts. And I don't think we've seen that anywhere being successful other than certain cities in Europe like Bremen and all of that. But it definitely feels that we need to bring, once you have these shared modes together in one place physically, you also need to integrate that in terms of like an app or a card or something like that, taking away some of the barriers of registration and those kind of things. So I think those are the two innovation, I will call them innovation because we are yet to see the prolonged success of those two in like widely. So those are the two innovations that excite me the most in terms of the future.
You mentioned Bremen in Germany, just to kind of wrap it up, but
Yes.
another deployment that I think it's been pretty exciting. on this side of the Atlantic is in Berlin with the Yelby app and kind of the integration of their shared mobility hubs in partnership with their public transit, their BVG system, and just this kind of seamless Discover Book and Pay platform. And the wayfinding, this kind of honeybee color scheme of black and yellow throughout the city of Berlin helps out a city of like over 4 million people seamlessly navigate, not to promote this platform because they're not sponsoring me, but I think it's interesting because of a mid to larger size European city sort of kind of did it quietly. And they did it at the digital layer and the physical layer, and they checked off all the boxes of mass, micromobility, car share, public transit, et cetera. And it's been quietly successful over the last several years. But then again, back to the US, a pilot project that which received a lot of buzz around 2021, 2022 was in Pittsburgh, the Move PGH project, which lasted about a year and a half, 2 years with spin scooters. It had a lot of promise, but then it eventually kind of sunsetted, shall we say, but maybe something of the Pittsburgh sort, kind of beyond a pilot, could be something interesting for a Detroit or a Cleveland or St. Louis or whatever. Let's see. The Pittsburgh example, I believe, was a bit truncated. So I'd love to see something that scale out, maybe. I don't see the Yelby Berlin experience in the United States, but something a bit more on a reasonable scale, maybe on a neighborhood scale, could be really cool. But let's see, we don't know. So I guess those are our final thoughts here. But just to kind of bring it back to full circle here. So just to kind of close out for everyone, thank you all to the panelists for your insights. And that is a wrap for today. Huge thanks to you guys who joined us. And a big shout out to UMX for sponsoring today's session. So check out urbanmobilitycourses.eu for their extensive course catalog, expert videos, and in-person trainings, including courses on topics like today's discussion. Thanks again for being part of the City's First podcast on LinkedIn. And for everyone else, I'll see you next month for another deep dive. Our next issue will be on mobility data and AI, so that'll be really exciting. But once again, thank you, Julie. Thank you, Darius and Venkatesh. It's been an absolute pleasure to kind of hear your perspective. I'm honored to have you join, and I think this was one of our best episodes, so I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Pleasure's all mine.
Pleasure's all mine as
Thanks so
well.
much.